Hello, this is Ken Samuelson. I'm here in Reidsville, North Carolina with Mr. Warren Bailey. Today's date is December the 28th, Friday the 28th, 2001. And I live at 545 Southwood Drive in Eden, North Carolina, 27288. My telephone number is 623-7787. And Warren, would you identify yourself for the listening audience?
Well, thank you, Ken. I'm Warren Bailey, and I live at 291 Woolen Store Road, Reidsville, which is about 10 miles out of Reidsville. And we've lived here since 1973, and we moved back here.
And when were you born?
I was born in Wake County, which is in a little village called Carpenter. It was a small village at that time, and my father was with the railroad. He was a railway section foreman, and he worked with the Durham Southern Railroad, which ran from Dunn, North Carolina, to Durham. And his primary purpose, I think, when it was built, was to haul tobacco from Durham to Dunn, and it would meet the coastline. I think it was the Norfolk and Western that would at Durham, and it met the seaboard at Apex, and the coastline at Dunn.
And what was your date of birth, Warren?
Beg pardon?
What was your date of birth?
Date of birth was the 1st of September, 1920.
1920, okay. So you went to school in Carpenter? Was there a school
in
Carpenter?
Well, actually, there was a little three-room school at Carpenter, and later on, and that was the first year, and I was sick quite a bit my first two or three years, and I had a lot of childhood sicknesses, and I was held back a couple of years. But anyhow, I went to, they built a consolidated school called Green Hope, which consolidated Green Level School and Carpenter School, and there I went to school there in my early years.
Okay, so you went to school there, and what was it, consolidated school, I guess? Is that what they call it?
Consolidated school. They consolidated the two schools, as I said, Green Hope. It was Green Hope. They named it after, well, actually, it was named after two different churches. It was Good Hope Church and Green Level Church, but there was a school at Green Level and a school at Carpenter. The small schools there, and they consolidated those into Green Hope.
So you're growing up, you were kind of out in the country, would you say? Or?
That's putting it mildly. We were in western Wake County, and at that time, there was very little there. There was a country store in the village of Carpenter. As a matter of fact, there were two small stores in the village of Carpenter, which was about 15 miles from Durham.
Now, did you go to high school then in that area?
I went to high school at Green Hope, but I actually graduated my last year. We moved to Apex, which is about 7 miles away, and I graduated from Apex High School.
Okay, so you graduated when in 19...
Beg pardon?
Graduated in 1938 or 39?
39.
Okay, so what did you do after you graduated?
I went to NC State College. It was NC State College at that time. I enrolled there, and later entered the ROTC program at NC State, and was in my junior year of ROTC at NC State when I went into the service. We didn't finish that year, and so...
When did you actually go into the service then?
I went into the service in April the 6th, 1943.
Okay, so... How many years did you complete then at NC State?
Pardon?
How many years did you complete at NC State?
I graduated after the war.
Okay.
But I was in my, well, actually I was in lacked less than a year of graduation when I was called in. But they were beginning to need more officers, and so they took us in. But we had to go to basic training first. Mm-hmm. They sent us to basic training, and they didn't have room for us in OCS at the end of basic training.
Okay, so you graduated from high school, went immediately off to NC State, or did you work any between?
No, I went immediately to
NC State. Okay, so let's go up to December of 1941. Okay, you were a sophomore, I guess, or whatever. I guess some of you were probably a sophomore. What did you know about the war at that time, you know, when it was building and all the controversies and all the things that were happening in Europe? What did you know, especially being an ROTC student?
Well, I knew that, of course, in 1941, when the bombed Pearl Harbor, and I didn't know where Pearl Harbor was, to be frank and honest with you, but
most
I knew it was
didn't.
A serious situation.
Yeah. Okay, you knew it was a serious situation, and of course you knew that the draft had already started, I guess, hadn't it? So you assumed you would be in the war, I would guess.
Well, I almost knew that I'd be in the war.
Because when you graduated, you certainly would. Now, you didn't graduate, though. You went in before you graduated. Were you drafted, or did you volunteer?
Beg pardon?
Did you volunteer?
No. They call the junior ROTC people in at that time. And as I said, they realized that we were green. And most of the people, you know, when graduated from ROTC, you went directly as an officer,
mm-hmm.
which would have been a mistake for me, I know, because I didn't know that much. I knew drilling and all that sort of thing, but I didn't know very much about how to handle a rifle or anything of that sort, mm-hmm. you know.
Okay. So you say the junior class was called up, is that
the idea? Yeah, the junior class of ROTC.
So you were called in, you were in effect drafted at that point then,
Or
called up?
We called it up. I mean, we really weren't drafted.
You didn't have any choice, though.
I didn't have any choice.
You didn't have any choice. So they said, come on, Warren, you're going in.
You and
how many other people went in from your class?
I don't really know how many there were in my class, but there were quite a number. And we went to two different, they sent us to two different places for basic training. I went to Camp Wheeler, Georgia,
mm-hmm.
and some of my classmates went to someplace in Texas, and I can't remember the name of the camp that they went to.
How about your ROTC training? How serious were they at that time about training you for war? I mean, how rigorous was this training at NC State, just out of curiosity?
Well, the training wasn't all that rigorous, but we all knew what the situation was, and we knew that we would eventually, if we stayed in the war, in which at that time things looked pretty dismal, you know, and we knew that we would be in, and they had Army personnel that were training us, you know.
Tell me the difference between your ROTC training before December 7th and after December 7th. Was there a noticeable difference that you recall?
I don't believe there was a note of, other than the fact that we were all serious about having to go into service.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody that I knew was anxious, actually, to go on into service.
Mm-hmm.
None of us that I know of had any bitterness or anything of this sort. It wasn't a matter like many people who were in the draft, you know, didn't want to go.
Yeah. How much advance notice did you get before you were actually activated?
Oh, I suppose about 30 days. I can't remember the exact amount of time, but I think it was maybe 30 days.
And was this at the end of a semester that you were called up? Is that
right? It was the end of, well, we were on a quarterly system, at that time, which meant that we were 3 months, 3 months, 3 months. We were called at the end of the first quarter, I guess it was, of my junior year.
So what did they tell you? You're activated 30 days from now. You got a piece of paper and said orders.
I can't remember the exact details or anything of this sort, but we knew something like maybe 30 days before we were to go in. And I don't remember the exact details of exactly when we were supposed to go, but we had about probably 30 days to get ready to go.
So you had a report to a particular assembly point then? That
we reported to Fort Bragg.
Okay.
And we were all reported at the same time.
Did you go down there on a bus, or how did you get to Fort Bragg?
Beg pardon?
Did you go down there on a bus? How'd they get you down there?
Well, yeah, we left from Raleigh on a bus. We assembled at NC State and went on a bus from there to Fort Bragg. And we spent some little time at Bragg. I don't remember the exact amount of time. And, of course, we were all anxious to know where we're going. We knew that we weren't going to stay at Bragg.
And did you already have your uniforms and everything?
Yeah, they issued uniforms there and, of course, gave you a haircut. And I remember very distinctly the barbers were, they said, they asked some of the people who had long sideburns, said, do you want your sideburns? And they said, yeah. If they said yes, they said, well, hold your hand up here, then we'll give them to you.
So you got a haircut right first off, huh?
Yeah, that was one of the first.
What else did they do? Did they give you a physical and make sure you're okay?
Right. We went through physicals, and I guess through the number of shots that we had, I can't recall all of them, but I remember the one that gave me more problems than any of the others was the tetanus shot.
Yeah.
I think I dreaded that one worse than any of the rest of them. But we got all the regular shots that they gave at that time.
Now, were you a second lieutenant then?
At that time, no. I was a PFC. They sent me in as a PFC.
So you went from the ROTC. You were an officer in the ROTC, I guess, or what were you?
Yeah, right.
Or officer candidate? What do they call you?
They just called us a candidate.
Candidate, okay. You're an officer candidate.
Candidate.
Okay. And then you went in as a PFC officer candidate, I guess,
whatever
you want to call it. Okay, so how long did that last, PFC Bailey?
They sent us to Camp Wheeler, Georgia, which is just outside of Macon. And originally when we went there, they said you'll be in three months of training. During the time they were there, they said we're going to extend it one more month. And then we thought, you know, we're sending us to purgatory or someplace. And we wanted to go on, you know, to OCS. Well, when we finished training at Camp Wheeler, we thought we'd go directly to Fort Benning to officers training school, but they said the classes are full at this time, so they sent us back to NC State. And so we spent some 3 months back at NC State in school.
And what were your subjects at school at that time?
Well, most of them, you chose your subjects primarily in, I remember one of the, one or two of the classes that I had, of course, English and geography and...
No military subjects?
We did. We went through military training while we were there, like we were back in ROTC.
Okay. So you took, like you say, regular classes like in geography and then military indoctrination, I guess, at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So what was your day like at NC State? Was it a real long day? where you had to do your regular classes
oh,
and
yeah.
your homework and then
it
training?
It was different than it was when we were in regular school. We were we had to be at bed at a certain time and things of this sort. It was more like military life mm-hmm. when we went back there.
Did they have rigorous inspections of your bed, the way you made it up, and the cleanliness
I don't recall that we had that at that time, but we had military classes, and we had people that supervised us a little more closely than we were mm-hmm. when we were regular students.
Now, who did you report to at that time? They had some officers there, regular Army officers?
Yes, they had regular Army officers there that we reported to.
And did they handle your training in military subjects?
Yes. Yes, they did.
Okay.
We had sergeants, and we had, I think, the highest-ranking officer we had there was a major, mm-hmm. if I recall correctly, that was the highest-ranking officer that we had there at that particular time.
So you were there about 3 months doing this?
Yeah, right.
Now, when did you leave there? Did you just approximate time? Do you recall?
We left there.
Time of year.
I was trying to think the date, but we entered OCS at Fort Benning, and I can back off 4 months, I guess, and I graduated from OCS in June of 1944.
Okay.
So you back off 4 months off of that, and mm-hmm. that's when we went there.
Okay, so you went down to Fort Benning then?
Right.
And was this called OCS?
OCS, okay. Officer Training.
Officer Candidate School.
Yeah.
Okay, now how rigorous was that, and what did you do? What was your day like?
It was very rigorous, and I can tell you this, that my training in basic training carried me through OCS, because I don't think I would have ever made it otherwise.
You mean your basic training through ROTC and so forth?
No, the basic training that I took right after I went in back into the service.
Okay.
I went into the service, I should say. And it was pretty rigorous. That was very rigorous. We were making 20-mile marches on a pretty regular basis. And we were mingled in with a lot of other people. Like we had a bunch of people who were coal miners out of, this is backing up to...
And this is prior to you going back to NC State, right?
Right, yes.
Yeah. You had basic
training at Camp Wheeler, Georgia.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And it was very rigorous training. And going back to what we did at OCS, it was very similar in many ways. We've made long marches and...
You're still a private... OCS?
Big pardon?
You're still a Officer Canada private?
I was a corporal.
Corporal,
they,
okay.
They promoted us to corporal.
Okay.
which was a big deal, you know.
Got a few extra bucks, I guess, huh? A few extra dollars in your paycheck.
Yeah, right.
You did get paid, I assume.
Yes, yeah, they paid us. I think maybe we went from about $21 to $30 a month.
Okay. So OCS lasted about how long was it?
4 months.
4 months.
4 months.
Okay, and tell me what a normal day would have been like in OCS. What would they do?
Well, we were up early in the morning. I think around 5 o'clock or something of this sort. Of course, you would have like it was in basic training. You have reveille.
Yeah.
And then it was different depending on what you were taking at that time, whether you were doing map reading or...
Well, you went to breakfast, I guess. You
oh, yeah.
Got up at 5.
Yeah,
you had to fall out in front and march to breakfast?
Right.
And did you have to police your barracks before you left?
Beg pardon?
Did you have to police your barracks before you left for breakfast?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
you have to clean up the showers and make sure everything was spit and polished?
Right.
How about your bed?
It had to be made to specification.
Drop a quarter on it and it bounced?
Yeah, right, exactly.
How about your locker? How did that have to look?
That had to be neat, and your clothing hung at a certain way, that they gave you instructions on how to hang your clothing, and it was a whole ball of wax.
Did somebody inspect your barracks after you guys left to make sure everything was right?
Yes. Yeah.
And what, did you ever get any demerits? You get any demerits of any kind for not making your bed properly?
I don't recall ever getting any on that particular thing. I got gigged on some other things, I think.
Gig, that's actually the word I meant to say. Yeah. Did you get gigged on? Okay, so then you, after you did all this in your barracks, then you fell out in front and had to march to breakfast, I guess, right?
Right, and I can't remember all of the routines that we went through. But
did you have good food? Do you remember?
Times, yes. It was a little better than it was in basic training, I can say that.
Did you have to line up like on a big buffet with a silver, you know, metal tray and go through the line and this kind of thing?
Yes, yes. We did get to go, you know, off base on the weekends and things of this sort. And let me back up just a minute. In the meantime, before I went into OCS, I was married. I got married, and I met a young lady in Durham, and she was from here. That she was born right near where we're talking right now, and she was an only child. But she accompanied me to OCS, and
Didn't you have to stay in the barracks?
I stayed on the base, but on the weekends I could come.
Oh, okay. So
unless you had some duty or something of this sort, if I had duty on the weekend, I had to stay on the base.
So you saw your wife on the weekends,
right?
Huh? Yeah. Okay.
She lived in Columbus, Georgia, and we met a family there. A lady, her husband was dead, and she had a family. But anyhow, she took in boarders, and my wife stayed with her.
Mm-hmm.
And I would see her on the weekends.
So you had to pay a little.
Unless I had duty, which was fairly often, you know.
So you had to pay a little rental for her staying in that place and so forth.
Yeah, and that came out of that corporal's pay. But
you didn't have much left over, did you?
Well, wife worked some at a daycare. She was a graduate of, she was smarter than I was. She graduated, and she was a graduate of what was Woman's College at that time, which is now UNCG.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And she was a home economist, and she was working at the time that we were married, and she had an automobile. And so we didn't have it as bad as a lot of people did, I guess you'd say.
Yeah. So you went through this for 4 months, and the subject that you took, did they get a little more specific as to what you might be doing after you graduated? Did you kind of break you out into maybe field artillery or infantry or intelligence or whatever?
Well, we were, of course, ours was infantry training, you know.
Okay.
We were trained to be infantry officers.
So you knew that?
I knew that all the time.
Okay.
And so we went through the regular training of field marches, and we stayed in we bivouacked quite a bit, and it was a whole ball of wax as far as, you know, what we would be doing later on, and emphasizing leadership training, you know, mm-hmm. as to what we would do. We were going from being told what to do and being trained to tell other people what to do.
Right. Mm-hmm. So how did you feel like your training prepared you for what you faced later?
I think it was fairly adequate. I felt like I learned a considerable amount of on leadership training and things of this sort.
Uh-huh.
that carried me, did a lot of good for me later on.
Now, when you were going through OCS, what uniform did you wear during the day? What did
I wore just I wore a corporal's uniform, or in other words, an enlisted man's uniform.
Was it a full dress uniform, or you might say?
Right.
Every day, going to school?
Well, of course, we were...
Except
we
when
had,
you were on
there. Fatigues and things of this sort we wore daily, you know, but on the weekends we wore regular uniforms.
Okay. So daily you wore fatigues, basically.
Yeah, right.
With your stripes on your shoulder,
right.
Or on your arms and so on. And, okay, so... your daily activities then included a lot of physical training, is that?
A lot of physical training. We had obstacle courses that we ran. We did these 25 mile marches, I should say. And this was done at night a lot of times over some pretty rough roads and things of this sort.
How'd your feet hold up?
Mine held up pretty well. We had some people who had some problems, but I had held up pretty well.
You were probably used to a lot of this in your younger years.
Right. Well,
a lot of walking in the fields.
Right.
Okay. So your wife stayed there with you till you graduated.
Right.
And what was graduation day like? What did they do for you when you graduated? They line you up in a big, all you guys up in a field and the general passion.
You know,
review.
I can't remember all the details about it at that time, but I remember one of the things that the first guy who saluted you was supposed to give him a dollar. And of course, all of the cadre there, enlisted cadre around at OCS, they were anxious, standing around wanting to give you the first salute. So, and a dollar then, Ken, was a lot of money, a lot more than it is now.
So did you give the guy a dollar the first guy to sleep?
I can't remember who I gave it to, but there wasn't any shortage of people to give it to.
I'll bet. So did you know what was going to happen to you after you graduated? Or when did you learn what you were going to happen?
Just a few days before we graduated, we knew who we the outfit we were going to, mm-hmm. and believe it or not, I was sent to Camp Butner, North Carolina, mm-hmm. which is within about 25 miles of where I was born and raised.
Yeah.
And so we came to Camp Butner, and...
You were officially a second lieutenant at that time.
Second lieutenant at that time, right. And I was assigned to a rifle company, Camp Company C. I remember that very distinctly. And we hadn't been there but a few days until they came to me and said, we want to send you back to Fort Benning for 4 months of communications training. And so, I thought, well, I don't want to go back to Fort Benning, and I tried to get out of it and everything. They said, no, you're going back to Fort Benning to train to be a communications officer. And so I called my wife, and telephones were not easy, to get to at that hour, were not easily accessible at that time.
Right.
But we called a lady who, whom my wife had stayed with there, and said, we're coming back to Benning, can we come back? And she said, well, I'm sorry, but I've already rented the room that you stayed in, but we have a dollhouse out behind the house that you can sleep in. And so we went back to the same place. My wife stayed with her, and
you had to stay on the base?
No, I didn't. Well, I did a lot, some, but not as much. I was in. I could come home at night for the most.
You were
of the time.
Free to have, living facilities off the base.
Right, right. Okay. And it wasn't easy. But anyhow, to make a long story short, we found another place. That we had a room. This lady rented a house out to There's a couple of couples, another couple. And of course, at that time, I had a allowance for my wife, you know.
Yeah, you had a, yeah.
And going back to the other thing, too, when I was in OCS, I did have an allowance for her, which was very small. But when I was a second lieutenant, why, my allowance was better. And so we were able to rent the room at this house. And we had kitchen privileges, which mm-hmm. was real good. My wife was a good cook, so we fared pretty well.
Good. So you were supposed to be there 4 months, huh?
4 months.
And what was your day like at Fort Benning then? What did you do then?
We went through some of the same training, but it was focused on communications, wire communications, radio communication, and message center mm-hmm. communications. It's three different things, and we took training in this.
Tell me about, just briefly, what's wire communication?
Well, this is a telephone, and this is the most dependable communication, and I guess I focused more on that when I came back and took over the communications for the battalion mm-hmm. That I was in.
And, so it's actually stringing wires for...
Stringing wires, oh, right.
Okay.
In the infantry unit, battalion communications officer is responsible for the communication from the battalion to the four companies in a battalion.
Mm-hmm.
And supposedly, the regiment is supposed to get wire down to you to the battalion, mm-hmm. and the battalion is responsible for getting wire to the companies. And it didn't always work that way, but that was the way it's supposed to be.
Okay. So that was your first wire communication. Tell me about the other forms of communication you're talking about.
The other forms of communication?
You said there were three forms of communication.
The other was message center, which was the coding of messages. You had a cryptograph machine that supposedly any communication that you sent by...
And this would come from regiment normally?
Regiment
to the battalion?
Come from regiment, or you could send your messages to
your companies?
To the companies or to...
Back
well,
to
the regiment. We didn't do a great deal of cryptographing down to the company level, but it was always back to regiment.
Mm-hmm.
And regiment was supposed to be sending the cryptographic messages to you. And this, are you familiar with a cryptographic machine?
Well, I know a little bit about it.
Okay.
But how did you didn't string wires for a cryptographic machine, did you, or did you?
No. The cryptographic machine, all it did
was that wireless?
Was code the message. Then you put the coded message not on the wire.
Like a teletype machine, kind of?
No. It was for radio.
Uh-huh.
Radio.
So it was wireless communication.
Wireless, we sent it. And that was not the most dependable communication we had at that time. The radios that we had at that time were not as efficient, anything like as efficient as they are today.
Uh-huh.
But you can go to a Radio Shack and find for a few dollars, get radios that were better than we had at that time.
Was that pretty secure? How comfortable were you that the enemy didn't know your cryptograph?
Beg pardon?
How comfortable were you that the enemy didn't know, couldn't decode your messages that were sent by radio? Because they could pick those up, couldn't they?
Well, they probably could have, but the time element was such that it didn't really mean that much. And as a matter of fact, I've thought about it an awful lot since that time. I think it was foolish to have sent it a lot of messages, but the time you went to send it through the cryptographic machine, you cryptographed it yourself, then they've got to decode it at the other end. The time element was such that it meant nothing. And I don't think I ever even thought too much about the enemy picking up messages or anything of this sort that would do them any good, because it was, by the time that they could have gotten hold to it, why, everything had already taken place.
It already happened. How about the third one now that you mentioned?
The third one is radio.
The
radio that we've just mentioned. And it was, most of ours were sent in Morse code.
Okay.
So
that was open air and anybody could pick that up, right?
Yeah, they could send it. But even that was cryptographed most of the time.
Oh, it was? Okay.
Yeah, you cryptographed it and sent it to regiments, say, for example, or and ours was from battalion to regiment. A regiment, of course, went back to division. And I think the messages that were sent, say, from regiment to division was far more important than what we had, because all ours was, the time element, you know, was such that it didn't matter that much. But of course, those long-term plans that they had would have been,
because most of the messages you sent were for like immediate tactical type things.
Right.
Is that the
exactly.
Idea?
Well, for example, if we were in the latter stages of the war, we were traveling at long distances, and we wanted to know if regiment was going to get the wire down to us, just messages or that sort of thing, and we'd send a radio message back. And I thought, well, gosh, that's sort of foolish in one way to cryptograph this, and then they have to go through with it. We're talking about an hour's time sometimes getting it cryptographed.
And you need an answer now.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So
basically you had telephone and then the cryptograph and then...
That's a message center. And let me one other thing. We had runners out of message centers that we sent messages.
So you had another way to communicate then. When would you use a runner? When would you use a runner versus these other areas?
Okay, I'm trying to think of some specific incidences. If we had certain messages that we wanted to send back and get back in a hurry, and it was fairly safe for him to get back to regiment, we could send the man or down to the company for that matter, you know. But
typically, what were the distances involved, you know, between where you were, where the company, where battalion was, where the company was, and where the regiment was? Are you talking about what kind of distances typically would you say?
Okay,
were?
Now this.
Okay, so we're talking about the distances now between the companies and the battalion and the regiment. What were the distances typically?
Okay, this depended on the situation in the war.
Yeah.
At the beginning, when we first went into combat, the distances were relatively short.
And what's relatively short?
We're talking about a mile or so.
Wow, okay.
Well, let me explain one thing.
Okay.
The allotment of wire, this is the double E wire that we use, the allotment of the wire for a company was a mile and a half. Theoretically, that meant that you had a mile and a half of wire with you, okay? And at the end of the war, we were traveling 20, 25 miles a day. And at that time, there might be a distance of 5 or 6 miles between us and regiment.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be, from us down to the different companies, would be 2 or 3 or 4 miles.
Okay.
Now, you can see what my situation was. On paper, I had a mile and a half of wire. So what do we do to compensate for this? Well, number one is to keep in touch with regiment. And as I said earlier, theoretically, they're supposed to get the wire down to us. But that was not the case in many, in most of the cases, as a matter of fact. We were laying wire down here that regiment was supposed to be laying. Then we had to get wire down to the companies. After a day's fighting, it'd be a company A was in the position 2 or 3 miles over here, company B was in this position, company C was another position, mm-hmm. and company D was another position, which meant we had to get wire down to them. And to be sure that we could get wire, what we were doing all the time during combat, we were recovering wire that had been laid by somebody else. But the big...
Would you just find it? Or how did you know it was there?
Well, physically you could see it.
Okay.
Sometimes it was tank companies that put this out.
Did you have a device to wind it up very quickly?
Right, yeah, we had a wire reel. Okay. On the Jeeps
were they power driven, or did you have to wind them?
Had to wind it.
You had to wind it
yourself. Wasn't power driven, we had to do it by hand. But let me explain that one of the big ways that we used civilian wires, we'd check the two wires that we would see up here that we could physically see. We cut the end of the wire off back here to be sure that we weren't getting anybody, wasn't connected back here, and we'd travel down the road, say 3 or 4 miles, and following these two strands of wire, and to be sure that we were checking, that we're still in communication, or would be in communication once we got there, we'd go up at the end of that and cut that and check back through. And that was, we were using civilian wire lines to...
Oh, these are off of like telephone poles?
Right. The civilian telephone poles.
And if the telephone poles were going the right direction,
yeah,
you could...
if we were going in the right direction. And they usually had telephone lines going about most of the direction. At night, once we get there, and they were issuing us more wire than the book said, you know. But we were also recovering wire. I mean, they were issuing us more wire all along. But at night, then after the day's fighting, Company B would be in one little village down here, and Company A is in another one, and we would have to get communications in so that we'd be sure that we had communications at night.
With each company.
With these companies. Mm-hmm. So we would be out of communications with them for, say, a certain period of time. But then we would, at night, we wanted to be certain that we had communications back to the battalions and then, of course, back to regiment. This is when the danger really came in for us. Mm-hmm. We were traveling over territory that we'd never been over before. The maps that we were using were constructed from captured German maps. And many nights I spent a certain amount of time. When we get to the forks of the road, it wasn't like Yogi Berra said, take it. I'd get under the raincoat with a flashlight to read the map to be sure we were getting the right place and hoping that I had the right place. And then we had a sign and countersign that we had that we used daily. And as we approached the town, it was always anxious because you didn't want to get shot by one of your own sentries. Mm-hmm. And so they would give the sign, we give the countersign, and there was always relief whenever we could get by that particular point to get into the headquarters to attach the wire and head back to the battalion.
Now, can you give me an example of your sign and countersign?
Well, we might say, I don't remember any of the ones particularly, but it might be something like this, and you'd say, Durham, And the countersign might be North Carolina.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or, but they was issued on a daily basis, and you were certain that you had to be certain that
When did you get it? First, or as soon as you got up?
That basically? I can't remember the exact time, but sometime during the day you would get the sign and countersign, which would be for that night.
Primarily use it for that night.
You know.
Oh, you didn't use it during the day, or I guess if you had to, you.
I never did it because you know.
But if you were challenged, you'd have to.
Yeah,
get it.
If you were challenged.
Yeah.
But I suppose that we got it early in the morning. And I can't remember the exact details on it now. But you were certain before the end of the day, or we were, our particular case.
Particularly needed it at night.
Yeah.
Because you couldn't tell.
At night, when we were, this is when it became more important.
Yeah.
Because you were traveling into territory that we hadn't been in before.
Yeah, could have the enemy.
The companies had already gotten into there, you know.
Yeah.
But during that time, you were bypassing a lot of people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We've
kind of digressed here from and learned a lot about your communication work, but let's go back, if you don't mind, and go back to your time in North Carolina now before you went overseas.
Mm-hmm.
End of tape A, side one. The interview continues with tape A, side two.
And when you completed that, what did they tell you at that point as to where you were going?
They sent me back to my outfit sent me down there.
Uh-huh.
The 89th Division.
Right.
Sent me there, and I came back. I already had a place in the 353rd Infantry 1st Battalion,
uh-huh.
And that was where I was supposed to go. I knew that I was coming back there.
And where was your group while you were down in Fort Benning?
They were at Butner.
They were still at Butner. Okay.
And I came back and started training, and I didn't have a great amount of time between that and the time that we left to go overseas.
Okay, what time frame are we talking about now? Do you recall when you were kind of getting ready to go overseas? You went overseas what time of the year?
We went over in December of 1944,
I guess.
44.
Yeah. Turn tape now.
This is an editor's note for the transcriptionist. This is exactly the way the tape appears, so I left this in there.
From your training and communication to Camp Butner. And then they sent your whole regiment, was it your regiment up there?
Division was there.
Division was Camp Butner. So they sent the whole division overseas at that point,
That's
huh?
correct.
Okay, where did they send you first in the U.S.? And how?
When we left... Camp Butner, which you said is out of Durham,
mm-hmm.
we boarded a train.
Okay, so you went overseas in December of 44.
Right, we left to go overseas.
Left to go overseas.
Right.
And they sent you first on a train?
Okay, we boarded a train and we actually boarded out at Butner.
Uh-huh.
They had a railroad track out there at that time, and as we left, we had no ideas of where we were going. We ended up at a place called Camp Miles Standish, which is just out of Boston.
Mm-hmm.
They said if you can call back home, but you can't tell your wife where you are. You can talk to her, but. Most of the telephone call, or they said some of them at least, would be monitored. And we were afraid to even think of such a thing as to tell them where we were.
Mm-hmm.
So my wife didn't know where it was, but I did call her after we got there.
And what were you able to tell her?
That I was okay, and I was heading overseas, but I didn't know when or where or was going or anything of that sort. Mm-hmm. We didn't even know whether we were going to the. We thought we were going to the European theater, but we were not certain.
Yeah. Okay, so you called your wife and then you got on the train and left. Is that the or
no?
Or you already arrived when you called her?
Let me go back and explain. We had a Christmas dinner there at Butner, and she joined me and her parents. Joined us there for Christmas dinner, and shortly thereafter, we were to leave, And when we left, as I said, we went to Camp Miles Standish in the Boston area. And I called her from there, from Camp Miles Standish. Mm-hmm. And I could tell her that I was okay and that we were headed overseas, but I didn't know, you know, where we were going. We didn't, as I say, we thought we were going to the European theater, but we were not certain.
Let me picture this now. When you called her, were you calling from a payphone?
Pay telephone.
And was there a long line of guys all waiting to call?
I can't recall how long it was or anything of this sort, but we were there for several days, and I might have called maybe more than once from there.
But so it wasn't a last-minute rush for everybody to call. It's kind of like.
And while we were there, we had the duty of, well, they were actually let us go into Boston. I went into Boston while I was there, and believe it or not, this fellow, I'd never heard of Frank Sinatra. And this fellow, a friend of mine, said, "There's this young singer. I'd like to go in to hear him." And he was performing there in Boston, and we went in, and I had never heard of Frank Sinatra, and it didn't mean anything to me at that time either. But I was in his early years, you know, as he was getting underway,
sure.
And all the girls screaming and what have you.
So you heard Frank Sinatra very early on, huh?
Yeah, right. But I didn't know who he was.
Yeah, but I'm sure you enjoyed the performance.
Yeah.
So you had time to relax a little bit, I guess, huh?
Right, and one of the principal duties that we had there, of mine, was at sense of mail. You know, we had open ever that had a certain number of.
That's of because letters. You were in the communications area.
Beg pardon?
Is that because you were?
No, it was any officer was. We had a lot of officers that had the same duty.
Now, whose mail were you censoring?
Everybody that went out.
Officers, enlisted men, whoever.
Yeah, I read. High-ranking officers' mail.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But I want to explain one thing here.
Okay.
I had to censor my men's mail while I was overseas. And I can tell you to this day that I never, ever divulged anything that I read in that letter because I thought that was extremely important that it never, ever get beyond what I read. Only thing that I was interested in was if he was saying anything that they told us that was against the rules and so forth. But I can tell you for certain, I have friends that were boys that were under me at that time, and I've read their letters, and I don't even remember. Frankly, I don't remember anything that I read.
Mm-hmm.
And
did
the only
you,
thing that I was interested in was to be sure that there was nothing that, because once after you had censored it, somebody else could have censored it and gotten me in trouble.
Yeah. Did you find yourself having to block out certain, what did you have
cut
special?
Cut it out.
Oh, you cut it out.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you had a razor blade that you.
So you couldn't see through it at all. And
you cut it completely out.
Right? Oh, okay. Did you find yourself having to do that when many of you?
Some, occasionally, you know, they'd tell something about where they were, things of this sort, which to me now, I realize that it wasn't that important, but it was important to this extent. The people in the higher echelons had told you that what you had to take out, and that was what you did.
Yeah. Plus, you never knew, you know, loose lips sink ships.
That's right.
You never know.
But I emphasize again that what I read, and it was the most unpleasant duty that I ever had.
Yeah,
I'll put it that way.
Reading a lot of personal.
Reading somebody else's mail.
Yeah, a lot of personal stuff. I'm sure very touching mail, too, sometimes.
Right.
Okay, so you were there at Camp Miles Standish then for how many weeks, would you say?
Oh, we were there for something like 10 to 14 days. I can't remember the exact amount of time that we were there.
And it was pretty relaxed time, and did you?
No.
Other than
one of the things that they would they would allow the men to go into, went to Providence, Rhode Island. They could go to Providence. And I was on, had duty one night as an MP. I had to escort, they had to have an officer with the MPs. Of course, they handle all the duties and everything. And I had one night had duty going with the MPs and having to herd these boys back on the bus, and they were pretty rough on them. I had to get, you know, be pretty strict on them not to get too rough on the boys, because some of them were drinking pretty heavily and things of this sort. But that was one of the worst duties that I had while I was there. But it was censoring mail and things of this sort. Mm-hmm. And getting other preparations for going overseas.
Did you have a structured day, you know, when you were there? I mean, was it pretty structured? Did you kind of do your mail censoring when you felt like doing it? Or did you have to come in at 8 o'clock in the morning and start doing it?
Structured to the extent that we had certain duties that we had to take care of, mm-hmm. like censoring mail and things. So that was the biggest thing that we did, that I did at least while I was there.
That would be very time consuming, I would think. Okay, so then you got orders to go overseas, and what was that procedure then?
Well, I didn't know where we still didn't know where we were going. We did. We boarded ship, and I was the ship that I was on was the Marine Wolf, with the Victory.
Tough name, Marine Wolf.
But we boarded the Marine Wolf. My battalion did, uh-huh. We left out of the Boston Harbor, and before we got out of the harbor, I was sick. Ship was, and we took the North Atlantic route.
Pretty heavy seas and all.
The ship was
rolling,
moving so that there was a bottle of water. I remember that very distinctly on the counter. We were sort of eating at the counter. And the bottle of water went from one end of the counter to the other. And I grabbed my helmet. That's what we use, you know, to upchuck in.
Yeah.
And ran. And I had a steak in front of me now, believe it or not. And I just had to leave it. And we were on the ship 11 days going over. And I ate an orange or something of that sort. I don't remember what I ate, but very little. I ate very little in that 11 days going over.
How and crowded was the ship?
Beg pardon?
How crowded was
very
the ship?
Very crowded. We had people down in the hole, you know, and bunks
stacked,
you know,
up and so on.
Everything. But I tell you,
what did the officers have to sleep in? As an officer, what did you
do? I had to stay with my men. I was supposed to stay with my men.
Oh, okay.
I was so sick that I had a sleeping bag, and I went out on deck, and I slept on deck most of the night.
I've heard that story before.
And I was sick, and we landed at where we were supposed to land at Southampton in England, and it was during the Battle of the Bulge, and they were rushing us over to because they didn't know what the situation was at that time, you know, whether they'd break out of it or not. And so we landed in, they changed the orders on the high seas. Our advance party had already gone to England to set up for us landing there. And they changed the orders, and then we landed at Le Havre. And that's when they loaded us on these cattle trucks after we got off, and carried us out to what was in Lucky Strike. Mm-hmm. The tents hadn't even been put up or anything of this sort. Snow on the ground, and it was very, very cold. My feet, I don't know why I didn't get frostbite.
What kind of clothing did you have to wear? Were you fully outfitted for
the
weather?
The regular GI clothing, and thick socks and things of this sort.
You having a heavy overcoat and all?
Oh yeah, I had an overcoat and everything. Mm-hmm. And had and when we got there, we had you know, to use our sleeping bags and so forth. But we got there and a few days after we. And let me back up just a little bit and say, now you can imagine I hadn't eaten anything in 11 days.
You were weak.
I was very weak.
Yeah.
And I could have eaten anything at that time, but then they issued a couple of K rations and said, don't eat them. This was the foolishest thing that I could, you know, and here were things that I was supposed to enforce. And
you wanted them more than anybody.
Yeah, and I wanted it worse than anybody. And but at any rate, they punished a few guys for eating it. They were, and which I thought, look, if you're hungry, you don't know when the next one's coming. Okay, but if you're hungry at that time, let you eat at that time. That was my feeling. But at any rate, we got into camp, and they finally got set up the kitchens, and the mess sergeant was a good friend of mine, and he was slipping me stuff to eat, and I came out of it all right. But let me explain something else. It wasn't but a few days after we got there that the weather warmed up a little bit and started melting, and the water was flowing everywhere. And some guy from regiment, or I guess he's from regiment, thought that it would be a good idea to dig holes to run the water into. And you can imagine now what happened. The guys running around falling in these holes. They had an engineer outfit that had landed in the camp, and they got them to come and survey some little trenches to move the water out, which worked real good.
Yeah.
But we were there for a few days. I don't remember the number of days. And from there, we moved heading up to combat. And
the Battle of the Bulge was still raging.
Battle of the Bulge was still on, but you could see the end of it at that time. Mm-hmm. Patton had moved his up, you know, but he didn't get there, you know. They broke out before he actually got there. So they were sending us up to join Patton's army, and we went up to a little town called Trayport, which is right on the English Channel. And while I was there, while we were there, I met this little girl. Saw this little 12-year-old girl. She looked like she was about 8. And I had written letters to my wife and told her how cute she was and everything, you know. So I wished we had one like her and that sort of thing. And she gave me a picture, a school picture and so forth. And I carried the picture in my pocketbook, and finally I sent it to my wife, and later on I 1993 or 1994 somewhere in that neighborhood, I decided I wanted to find her, and it's a long story, but anyhow, we did find her, and they finally came over here and visited us.
Really? Know?
But anyhow, we found out that...
We'll hear more about that later.
Okay.
I want you to tell me about that. Anyway, go ahead.
Okay.
So you're heading up toward Patton's Arm.
And we went to Trayport. And from Trayport, we went to Luxembourg. And the luckiest thing in our life that ever happened in my life, I guess, happened at that time. We had a battalion commander who was totally incapable of handling a battalion. We all knew it, but wasn't anything we could do about it. And while we were at Luxembourg, just before we went into combat, they sent us a replacement for him. And he was a major at that time, Major James Morris. who had been in combat for some time. And he, I can say without a doubt, that he's probably saved a lot of lives in my battalion.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very, very capable individual
mm-hmm.
who could lead and knew what to do with artillery.
Was he regular Army? Do you know?
Yes. No. He was I think he was National Guard.
Really?
If I remember mm-hmm. correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Out of Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it's where he came mm-hmm. from, Pennsylvania. He was in that area, you mm-hmm. know. And a very, very capable individual and a very nice fellow, too.
Mm-hmm. So he was your division commander, you said?
He was battalion commander. He was battalion commander.
Yeah.
And it's very, very important to have somebody in that position. I think even more important sometimes than regimental commander. Because he's very close to the action, you know. And he knew how to use artillery. He was expert at that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's highly important.
Okay, so you're in Luxembourg and get a new...
Got in Luxembourg.
Battalion
and
commanding
from there we
officer.
Went into combat near the town of Trier in Germany. And we made...
How did you get there? On trucks? Or...
Yeah, trucks.
Mm-hmm.
We went by train to Luxembourg
mm-hmm.
out of Lacrayport.
Mm-hmm.
And... from there, we used the trucks, our trucks.
In very crowded conditions on the trains?
Oh, yeah.
Or?
Yeah.
Didn't improve any, huh?
I'll show you a picture in a minute.
Okay.
Of me on a 40 and 8, you know. You know what a 40 and 8 is?
No. Right?
Well, that's the French, I call it a French Pullman car.
Uh-huh.
It's 40 men or 8 horses.
Okay.
And there's some from World War One. There was an organization called they called it a 40 and 8, but it's actually what it is. And it's printed on the rail cars, the French yeah. rail cars. It's 40 men or 8 horses, chevaux, you know, 40, hold 40 men or 8 horses.
Oh, I see. That's interesting.
And I have ridden a many mile on that, many, many miles across Europe. We went up, as I said, we went from Lacrayport up to Luxembourg, and from there we took our trucks to go into combat.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember the division that we replaced, but anyhow, we joined Patton's Army,
mm-hmm.
and we were in support of the 4th Armored Division. Then from there, we went,
When you got up and joined Patton's Army, what did you actually do? I mean, what were your first things that you had to do when you got there? Did you have to start stringing wire immediately?
Oh, yeah. What? Yeah, we had to get our positions in place,
mm-hmm.
but we began to get pretty mobile at that time, mm-hmm. as you probably know.
Because Patton was moving so fast, right?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. It hadn't really gotten into the rat race at that time, but it was beginning. Our first assignment was to make the assault crossing of the Moselle River,
mm-hmm.
which we did. 11 days later, we made the assault crossing of the Rhine.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something.
Now, when you made the assault crossing of the Moselle River, what kind of opposition did you have at that time?
Not a great amount of opposition.
Now, was the bridge still standing?
Beg pardon?
Was the bridge
no,
still
we,
standing?
No, we went across on boats.
But okay.
But Moselle was.
Did
not
you do a pontoon bridge or anything of that nature?
No, we didn't. We didn't. Some of the engineers might have built a pontoon bridge after we. Crossed, I don't know, but that wasn't the important crossing. We made the crossing there, and this was the waters were not as swift, and I had to lay a wire line across the river. Though we tied in at one cross, and we just reel the wire out and
just lay it on the bottom or whatever.
Just let it go and
yeah.
And of course let it give it enough
slack to
slack that it could you know it could go to the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, this tied us in with regiment. It kept us in communication with the regiment. And then of course after we got across, we had to get the wire to the companies, but we didn't get the opposition there. There wasn't a great amount of opposition, but that was the first German we killed.
What did you see as you was crossing the river? Now you had some opposition, right?
Not a great deal. Not there.
Was there anybody shooting at you?
No. Well, it did before we got across the river.
Uh-huh.
My men were out. Had to climb a pole, and they were shooting at them. That was the night before we made the crossing. Next morning,
mm-hmm.
And they were shooting at them at that time. But from across the river.
What kind of light?
It was just heavy. It was just the infantry. Rifle fire.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't even hit any machine gun fire.
Mm-hmm.
My platoon didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But after we made the crossing there, we went on to the we were within about 2 or 3 miles of the Rhine, and we knew that we were supposed to make the assault crossing of the Rhine sometime later, but it was 11 days after. This is, I think it was the 24th of March, I believe it was, of 45. And we were making preparations for that. But the Signal Corps, the Rhine was so swift, we didn't even attempt to lay any wire across there. The Signal Corps laid that heavier wire across the line. But I did what I my duties was when we got across the Rhine, I was supposed to tie it in at a little railroad station. It was a little terminal there, and there weren't the trains running, and I tied the line in, labeled it, and then we moved on up. The banks were real tall, and we went through the grape vineyards and so forth, laying the wire up after we crossed the line.
Mm-hmm.
But the exciting part of it was before we got across, that morning we went down to make the crossing. Company C, I believe it was, had got one platoon across there, and we're supposed to make the crossing with these engineer boats, which you paddle, you know, mm-hmm. you paddle it across and then send one man back with it. Well, they got across there with one wave of troops, and the water was so swift that it took all of the boats right down the river. And somebody had realized that this might happen. And they had Navy ducks sitting back, and it took about 2 hours to get them down there. And they had these Navy ducks that came in and shuttled us across.
Mm.
And I was lying in a ditch.
Are we getting any fire at this point?
Oh. The 88s were firing, and they were using time fire, and it looked like, you know, you could see it hitting the water out there. Of course, I wasn't watching very much until I got ready to go across. They'd sent several infantry platoons across ahead of us, and then it came time for us to go. We had to load all our equipment on the boat, on the duck, and it so happened right where we crossed is a little town called Oberweisel, and the water, they had cobblestones. They came right out of the water, and they could roll those ducks right up on that, and on the other side the same thing, and they would pull up there, and the troops would load on and then head out to the across the river. And I will always have a great admiration for those young men who were driving those ducks. Now, I was lying in a ditch on the western side of the river, and until the time that we got ready to go, and it was just a tremendous amount of artillery fire. Mm-hmm. It was 88
point blank.
No, it was most of it was time fire.
Oh, okay.
And
where were the
river
what?
On the river? But now when it came.
How far from the river were the 88s, would you say?
Oh, I mean, they were probably a mile.
Okay, so they were. Okay.
They were flowing it over.
Yeah, okay.
And a friend of mine, I was a boy, a sergeant, was in another platoon in my company. He got curiosity, you know, and he crawled out of that ditch that we were in, and he got hit pretty seriously with it. We could hear this artillery coming, you know.
What did it sound like?
And when as long as you could hear it, you felt safe. But if it's up in this angle, about a 45 degree angle from you, and if it cut off, you knew it was coming close.
Mm.
It always came close whenever you hear it, whoo, whoo, that whistling sound.
Mm-hmm.
And as it approached, if you, like I said, if you could hear it, you knew it was going over.
Mm-hmm.
But when it cut off before you got to you, you knew it was coming fairly
close.
Very close,
huh?
And so I was anxious to get across the river because we knew then, you know, the artillery was going over us. And the only thing it could hit us with at that time was either machine gun fire or mortar fire.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't.
Was there much of that going on?
No, we didn't have much mortar fire, but once we got across and got up on, once you got up on the across the river and there's
the
vineyards that you went,
mm-hmm,
up, and it leveled off once, mm-hmm, you got on the top, and they started shooting at us with 20 millimeter anti-aircraft. They leveled it out, you
really?
Know, and shooting at us with that.
Is that right?
Yeah, and we were
Point blank range.
Point blank, right. Yeah.
Was that a very, anti-aircraft, that a lot of shrapnel, right?
Was yeah, any, yeah.
So yeah. Pretty dangerous
yeah.
stuff.
And
what did that do to your troops? I mean,
beg pardon?
What did that do to the men that were with you? I mean, were many of them injured or killed from
we
that?
We didn't get a tremendous amount of casualties. We got a few people killed and a few people that were injured, but it wasn't as bad as you might expect under those circumstances.
Would machine
we didn't
gun?
We had the advanced troops that went over. We had one fella who was killed in C Company, and that was the company that I was supposed to have been in, you know, mm-hmm, if I hadn't been going back to communications training.
Training,
and but anyhow, we got several casualties in C Company, and one fellow named Saul Collier, who was a platoon leader, and he got hit in the neck, and he was paralyzed the rest of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one that I can remember.
Now, at this point, what was your leadership responsibility at this point?
What was my responsibility?
Your leadership responsibility. Who did you have that you were responsible for?
I had, of course, my platoon.
Okay.
I had.
And how many men were in your platoon?
Beg pardon?
How many men are in your platoon?
About 30. Mm-hmm. I had about 30 people. And it was my responsibility to keep them together.
Were you the only officer in the platoon?
I was a platoon leader.
Yeah. Okay.
Now I had sergeants, you know. I had a wire sergeant, fellow that was in charge of the wire section. I had one that was in charge of the radio, and one in charge of the
crypto
message center.
Okay.
But they were all moving along. We had three jeeps, I guess it was, in the battalion. Well, I walked most of the time. I wanted to be with my men.
Yeah. Okay, so you got up on this field, and they were shooting at you with a 20-millimeter anti-aircraft.
Right.
Would the machine gun fire have been more dangerous than the 20-millimeter?
Oh yeah, I think so. And by that time, most of our rifle companies had taken care of the local. They had machine gun nests that were right on the banks of the river,
mm-hmm.
or near the banks of the river, but they had eliminated them by the time we got over there.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, so you're up on this field then, and
right.
and you're kind of ducking for a while, I guess, with this
right.
stuff.
Let me explain. I was walking along, and they were shooting this 20-millimeter stuff, and I went down to my knees. And I looked, and here was this Major Morris, and he was still walking. And I said, I can't stay down here. I got up and started walking, just like he was.
Mm.
Now, that was a leader.
Yeah, I would say. Very risky occupation back then, wasn't it? To be a leader, and of course he had to lead his men, and boy, he led them in the best way he knew how.
That's right, exactly.
He was exposed.
He was truly a leader.
Courageous guy.
Right.
So how did that develop then? Were you able to knock out these, anti-aircraft nests?
Yeah, they were pretty well taken care of. Of course, they kept moving back, you know. And I can't remember what happened at the end of the day there. I don't even remember the town that we were in. That we usually ended up in a little town someplace or another.
But you were stringing wire all the time, I guess.
Yeah, we were stringing wire all the time.
Mm-hmm.
We were stringing wire as we went up the cliff there. And
I have a little trouble visualizing you getting enough wire to keep going. Your regimental headquarters had to keep moving up, didn't they, along with you as you progressed? They would progress too, would they not?
But the regimental communications officer, we didn't see him very much. He didn't get close enough to the action, you know, but I would see him, you know, at the end of the day or whatever, you know, when the fighting got less.
Did you have any trouble at night with any infiltration in your troops, among your troops, particularly?
Not as much as you might think there towards the end of the war. We had to be very careful, though. We had sensors out all the time.
Mm-hmm.
At night, you know, and we'd go. What we'd do is we'd confiscate houses,
mm-hmm.
As we'd go into these little towns, and we'd set up our switchboard and everything in a house, and then start laying the wire out from our battalion headquarters down to the companies. And we, as I said, we had to be sure that we had the communications in at night, so that if anything did turn up, you know, that we'd be in communication.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, wire was the most dependable form of communications, although we did have radio.
How about walkie-talkies? Were they used much?
Oh, the platoon leaders had those.
Mm-hmm.
And each platoon leader, that is a rifle company platoon leader. The company commander had a 300 radio, which is fella carried on his back,
mm-hmm.
and they had this little walkie-talkie. The platoon leader had his walkie, but they were not dependable. They just in and out, you know, and they had these tubes and so forth. And it was constantly in repair. And I, as I said, I think you could buy something at Radio Shack today that would be twice as dependable as they were.
I guess batteries were a problem, too. They probably didn't have a long life either.
We had, and that was our responsibility, too, to be sure that we had a supply of those things, you know, to...
Oh, for the platoon leaders, huh?
For the companies, you know, we sent them down.
Oh, okay.
And, of course, they were supposed to let us know when they needed them, you know. But then we, our supply people kept them supplied with the, with the batteries and everything.
I see.
That was not the biggest problem. The biggest problem was the tubes and things of this sort, that, all of those radios. It was just hard to keep them in communicating.
Yeah. You see, they getting jostled around and everything, break a tube or whatever. Okay, so continue on. What happened to you then?
Okay, after we crossed the Rhine, I really got into a rat race. This is when we really were traveling. We thought at one time after we crossed the Rhine that the war was pretty near over with, but then it lasted for a good long while after that.
Patton got his tanks across, right?
Beg pardon?
Patton got his tanks across the Rhine River.
See, we bridged the Rhine for the 4th Armored Division.
Okay.
And they and the engineers put the pontoon bridge where we made the cross.
Right. Okay.
And then they came in with the tanks.
Yeah.
And then, they moved through us.
Mm-hmm.
The 4th Armored Division moved through us and started moving in a hurry. And this is when we first ran into what they call the autobahns.
Mm-hmm.
And the tanks would get on these autobahns and go, you know, barreling down, and they'd drop off at the intersections, they'd drop off a recon outfit, you know, or maybe a motorized unit with a few machine guns and what have you on it. But anyhow, let me give you a story on one of the things that happened. We were at the town of Eisenach. We were on the outskirts of Eisenach. There's a little village up near there, and with about a mile from Eisenach. And the 4th Armored Division had bypassed us and gone about 20-some miles beyond us. Now, here we are, sitting there ready to take Eisenach. And our battalion executive officer, I can't recall his name right offhand, I'll think of it in a minute. But anyhow, he volunteered to go over and put a white flag on a Jeep, drove down to the German front, and said, "We want to talk to your commander." And they said, okay. They blindfolded him, and they took over and drove and blindfolded our Jeep driver and took him up to the headquarters. And he told them, said, we think it'd be wise for you to save your town. No, let's not destroy this town. And they sent two of their officers back, kept our officer over there, and sent two of theirs over and talked to us, and they said, well, they had orders from Berlin to hold and say, well, tonight we're gonna rip the place up with artillery fire. And said, well, we can't do anything about it, but anyhow, they sent our officer back. We sent them back, and they sent us back. And in the meantime, the 126 ordnance trucks were passing us in this road right in this village. And a friend of mine was in the 26th order, and I said, do you know Millard Ferrell? I stopped one of the trucks, and he said, oh, yeah. I said, he's the mail clerk in the outfit. I said, where is he? And he said, well, it's about 20 miles up the road here, up the autobahn. So I took a Jeep and went up and got up a short ways and at an intersection, and the MPs were there, and they stopped me and said, "Where are you going?" And I told them the town. I can't remember the name of the town now, but I knew it at that time. And I said, "To see a friend of mine." He said, "Well, I'll tell you what you do. He said, you drive as fast as you can drive, because the only thing we've done is gone through here and left off these recon outfits at these different intersections." And they had a black sergeant, the first sergeant, that had got, he and two officers, a major and a lieutenant colonel, had wandered off into a village off down below there. And they let them go through, the Germans let them go through to begin with, and they came back through. They started shooting at them, they jumped out, and they, the sergeant had the presence of mind when he was down, when they were shooting at him, to pull his, the pant legs out of his combat boot, stuck a 45 down in there. And the Germans, when they started to surrender, they killed the lieutenant colonel and the major. But they didn't kill the sergeant. And they started fiddling with the rifles afterward. And he whipped out the 45 and killed both of them. And ran up and got up on the inner bar, and they said, "Do you want him?" He belonged to the outfit up there that had been further up. I said, "Well, he can go with us if he wants to." He says, "No, he believed he'd stay there." But anyhow, we drove on as fast as we could, and my driver was a big old fat boy from New York. His name was McLeod. And we got up to this town, and I walked in, and I inquired as to where Millard was, Millard Farrell. They said, "Well, he's in his house down here," told me where he was. And I went in, and I walked in, and when I walked in, he said, "Well, what do you say, boy?" And I hadn't seen him in over a year. And we had a visit there, and I ate lunch with him. We had a little air raid while we were there. And so after that, I came back, and I never saw him until after the war was over. And he's still a good friend of mine.
Does he live here in Reidsville? Or
beg your pardon?
Where does he live?
He lives at near this little Carpenter, this village of Carpenter, where
he grew up.
Lives there now.
End of tape A, side two. The interview continues with tape B, side one.
We're supposed to meet the Russians on the Elbe River. We didn't quite get to the Elbe. We were very close to it, to the Elbe. And they issued us orders to me as a signal, as a communications officer. It said, "The Russians are going to put up, if you hear something at night out there," and we're afraid we'd run into a firefight, you know, said, if you hear something out there, said, "You're supposed to send up a green flare, and the Russians are supposed to send up a red flare." Well, we never met the Russians. Somebody, another outfit met them on there. But anyhow, they found out everybody along the front line of the lines there had the same orders, that you would send a green flare up, the Russians in turn would send a red flare. But it turned out that they didn't know anything about it. So I don't know what would have happened if it so happened that the outfit that met them was on the river, and they crossed the river from each other.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't know, when they get across and where they'd be. But anyhow, we were sitting there, and as you well know, the political thing was that the Russians are supposed to take Berlin. We could have taken Berlin long before they got there, because we were at Leipzig, which, is not very far out of, or we were near Leipzig, very far out of there. And I guess it was a good thing, but for me at least, but we were sitting there in a very static position, and we had nothing else to do. And so the battalion had an allotment of so many people they could send back to Paris for an R&R. And I got sent back to Paris from while I was right off the front line. And
now, who would replace you in a situation like that?
Well, My sergeants were well enough
over.
Aware of what to do, you know, and I had some very capable sergeants that could handle the situation in for a short period of time at least. I had the wire sergeant was the one that I guess I was closer to than the rest, because we depended on the wire more than anything else. And this was a young man out of Scranton, Pennsylvania. His name is Lim Bruni, and he's still a friend, good friend of mine. We communicate.
Do you?
There was a young kid that was in the message center, and I had assigned him as a runner for the captain. The company, the captain wanted a runner and go to places that he didn't want to go. and this kid named Barringer, he was a 18-year-old kid when he came into service. He's already married, had a little girl. And they're good friends of ours still. Another one named Ravel was in the wire section. I didn't know him too well, really, during the war, but I've met, we've been close ever since. And he's out of a place called Viburnum in Missouri. And he and his wife are good friends of ours, and his wife is very close to my wife. Mm-hmm. She's a very nice person. And this is Barringer, Lim Bruni, and Ravel. They're the three that I've been in contact with since the war.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like I was fairly close to my men. I never asked them to do anything that I wouldn't do myself, and I think they knew that.
So you went back to Paris on R&R.
Right.
Now, what was that like? Where did they put you?
Wild. Let me tell you, it happened that I was there the night they declared D-Day. I mean,
victory in Europe.
V-E-Day. Victory in Europe. You know, mm-hmm.
Yep.
They signed it.
Surrender.
Peace treaty.
Mm-hmm.
And they turned the lights on for the first time in 4 years in Paris when I was there. And I can tell you, it was wild. Some guy, the artillery observers, you know, the little Piper plane that they use for that.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Some guy flew flew one of those under the arch in the
Arc de Triomphe.
No, the Eiffel Tower.
Eiffel Tower. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
No, I don't think he could go on under the Arc de Triomphe part of it, but have you been to the...
I've never been there.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, seen pictures, that's
it. The Eiffel Tower is unbelievable. You can put at least 2 football fields under this thing, and it's bigger than it looks like it is, you know. But he flew an airplane under there.
Uh-huh.
Every military vehicle that you saw in Paris then was covered with French people. They were just piled onto this thing. It was a great celebration, and... it was
so. How long were you there?
Just 3 days.
3 days, and then you had to go back.
Back now. This is a strange feeling. Now, I left. When I left, we were fighting the Germans. You know, I mean, well, we were really in a static position.
Yeah.
Everything was we by all intents and purposes, we knew the war was over.
Was there any firing going on when you were...
Yeah, there was still a lot of...
Still firing.
The Russians still hadn't taken Berlin, you know,
okay.
when we left that.
I mean, in your particular unit, was there much opposing
nothing
fire?
Nothing, except we'd send a patrol out now and then and just, you know, to see what was going on out in front. That was the rifle companies would send these out.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as my unit was concerned, we weren't doing anything. We were just sitting there waiting for the Russians. And when we, like I said, we had an allotment of 3 officers that they could send back, and a boy from the motor officer, I believe it was, and a guy from, I forgot, B Company, I believe it was. whom I still, one fellow's dead and the other one is lives in Texas now. I went back with me that on at R&R. And it was an unforgettable experience being in Paris when they turned on the lights. You can imagine now, turning on the lights the first time in 4 years.
Excitement, gosh.
And so I went back, went back to part of the way I went, but at a certain way, distance, I can't remember exactly where I got on the train, but it came into Paris on the train. But we're going back, we went a certain distance on the train and then got on trucks and it took us back to our unit. And when I left, when you saw a German soldier, you were shooting at him, and when I went back, I saw someone walking around, you know. And it was a strange feeling, to be frank and honest with you.
Yeah. So these were soldiers that the war was over.
Yeah,
and they just were. They were still dressed in their uniforms at all?
Still dressed in the uniforms, a lot of them were. And I didn't see many, but there were some.
I guess they were.
Of course, along the Rhine, they had a lot of prison camps, you know, that had these prisoners of war.
Right.
But I guess these other guys, when the war was over, they just turned them loose and
told them to go home, I guess. I don't know.
But, you know, a lot of them. We used, after the war was over, we used them for duties that, well, like at the camp that I was telling you about that we ran at 20 grand, we used a lot of the German prisoners of war for help there.
Mm-hmm. Like KP duty or something of that kind? Or?
Yeah, they did a lot of that, and it was just a lot of things that they did, you know, around camp. That
clean up details.
And you give a private the opportunity of supervising these. He was in big time, you know. one of the things that they used them for various and sundry different things around the camp, you know, any kind of manual labor, and then some of them worked as cooks and different things of that sort.
So what happened to you then? You went back to your group, and how long did you stay there near the Elbe River?
Okay, we went back, and I stayed there at this little town of Teichel in Germany for a few days. And then we got orders to come back to France to run these cigarette camps. As I said, the troops that were running them weren't capable or didn't care or whatever, but anyhow, their GIs were getting sick and things of this sort, and they just took an infantry outfit to run the camp.
Mm-hmm.
And we took over. Of course, we had cooks, you know, that were capable of supervising the cooking and things of this sort. And all the other duties that took place did everything from running PX, you know, out of a tent, things.
So these camps basically were for soldiers, I guess, who were either on their way to the Far East.
Right.
Or else were going home, I suppose.
Right. Huh? Some of them were going home. Some of them had enough points that they were, you know, they had points that they...
So it was a temporary kind of situation.
Right, it was a transient camp.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd move a group of until the, and we were staging area for Le Havre.
Mm-hmm.
They send the troops out of Le Havre. We weren't that far from Le Havre, you know.
So how long did you stay there, Warren?
We came there in June of 45, and we stayed until the atom bomb was dropped. Mm-hmm. And because we were still an outfit that could have been shipped to the Far East.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, we thought that we would be shipped to the Far East.
Yeah.
And troops were coming through that were going to the Far East.
Mm-hmm.
And We stayed there until, well, let's see, it was dropped in August. And broke up our outfit in October of 1945. Mm-hmm. And then I was shipped back to Austria for the army occupation. I didn't have enough points to come home.
Oh, okay.
But let me go back a little bit. I had leave time coming, and so I was at 20 grand, and so they said, well, you can go on a leave to England. I was in London on VJ night.
Oh, boy.
Now, can you imagine that? Now, there's not many people.
Paris on VE Day.
VE Day in Paris.
London on VJ Day. Huh?
And VJ Day in London. And of course, that place was wild. Down at Piccadilly Circle, that went down there that night. And I remember talking to a bellhop there at a hotel. And he told me that the war was over. That was the first news that I got. It wasn't but a short while, so Piccadilly Circle was just jammed with people. And they were throwing firecrackers out there, and it was just wild. I got the heck out of there.
Just like Times Square, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly.
So what did, you were there on R&R again?
I was there on leave.
Yeah, so VJ Day, and you kind of got out of Piccadilly Square because it was too crowded.
Right. So
what did you do?
I had an opportunity to go to catch a train up to Edinburgh in Scotland.
Uh-huh.
And so I got out of London and went to Edinburgh on a train. And it was up, I don't remember the number of days of it, but while I was there, I had an opportunity to go out on Loch Lomond.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went up over there with some other friends. There happened to be a chaplain over there that I knew while I was at Fort Benning mm-hmm. in Georgia.
Oh.
His name was Buck Jones. And he was going on this Loch Lomond thing, and so I joined the group, and we went up there and had a picnic. We caught one of the paddle boats, went up Loch Lomond, and went up to the other end and had a picnic up there. We'd fix some sandwiches and one thing and another. And went up and then came back. And I don't remember how many days in Edinburgh, but that was very nice. I would have liked to have gone back there sometime. Mm-hmm. We've been back to Europe a few times, but I'd like for my wife to have gone to Edinburgh. It's a beautiful place.
Yeah.
But we didn't see the Loch Monster while I was.
So did you have to go back to France then?
Yeah, I went back to 20 grand.
Mm-hmm.
And then this was like in, well, you know, when the atom bomb was dropped. And of course, it was a few days after that before the Japs actually surrendered.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they surrendered while I was in London. I went back to 20 grand. And was there. We left out of there in early October. I don't remember the date, but anyhow, they broke up our division, the 89th Division, and sent it back to the States.
Mm-hmm.
And those of us who didn't have enough points to go home, which was most of us, went back to Austria in the Army of Occupation.
What city in Austria were you in?
Well, I first went to a little in Austria that's called the Gastein Valley.
Mm-hmm.
It's Hofgastein, Bergastein, and so they're all down this little valley there. And I went to Hofgastein first, was there for a few days, and then they shifted me to a place called Steyr, Austria.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there for a short while, then went to a town called Inns, I-N-N-S, Austria.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's right on the Inns River, and it was right next to, that's when you went across the Inns River, you were in the Russian-occupied zone. You had to go through that to go to Vienna. I never got to Vienna, but I had heard a lot of stories about, you know, the people that went on the train there and what they had to go through with and so forth. But
oh, the Russians gave them a hard time, you mean?
Yeah, different things, you know. When you come out of there, they de-louse you, you know. And, you know, actually, they were using DDT.
Oh, my gosh.
And I talked to one Englishman sometime after that, and he was telling me about being on the train and his GIs, and he was on the train and he was in a sleeping car, and this GI comes in and just, he called it a syringe, it was a duster, you know, he opened up his pajamas and shot the
DDT
in.
Oh my gosh.
But they didn't think about being that dangerous, I guess,
right.
At that time. But anyhow, when you come out of the Russian zone, they'd de-louse you. But I was there at Inns, and while I was there, I ran a displaced persons camp. They had a lot of people from different places, that, particularly the Balkans countries, a lot of them from Romania and different places.
Were some of them from the concentration camps too?
Some of them had been in concentration camps.
Yeah.
And
so they're looking for their family.
Beg pardon?
They were looking for their family, or their family was looking for them.
What they were doing, the most of them were there, were trying to escape the Russians.
Oh, okay.
See, Romania was with the Germans, you know, during the war.
Uh-huh.
And some of them were there, different people from different, I had Polacks, I had Romanians, Gypsies, you name it. And they just said, you've got the responsibility of these people. And it had it in an old cavalry barracks there. And it happened to be, there was a girl from Romania who was originally from Canada, and she spoke English like you and I do, plain English. So she was my secretary, or she's an interpreter and everything. And I had a GI that spoke two or three different languages that helped me, and we just had these people there, and we were responsible for keeping the food for them and everything, and we had these German prisoners of war who were the cooks.
Mm-hmm.
So we kept them there until time to ship them out or what have you, and they kept sending people in there, and they weren't sending anybody out, and the people were just wanting to get back home. So I started writing orders and putting them on a train. And believe it or not, they would get on the train and they could go where they wanted to, back to Germany or wherever, you know. Except the people from the Balkans countries, they some of them came in there on covered wagons and what have you. But one day I was out in the courtyard and I saw this little fellow speaking English. He was a little hump-shouldered guy. I said, where did you learn that English? He said, I worked for International Harvester for 20 years. And he got caught over there. His people owned a farm in Romania, and they went back, and he got caught over there. And he was back there in this place. But we had to get the food right off the economy. The people, they go out and get meat and
produce or whatever.
Yeah, whatever, milk, farm. You know, for they had children in there. We had to get milk for the children and things of this sort. And I was there, I ran that for, I don't remember how long, but finally we got rid of most of them. And then they sent me to a little town called Bruck in Austria, which is about 50 kilometers south of Salzburg. And it was a beautiful little town. And that winter, it must have snowed every day. Every day it was snowing. And it was beautiful, though. And I enjoyed it. And while I was there, I met this family that ran the photograph shop that I used to carry some film down to get it developed. And I later, after I got home, let me digress a little bit. And they had a little boy. His family, this lady in there had a young boy who was about, I guess he was about 2 or 3 years old, 3 or 4 years old mm-hmm. at the time, and I'd give him candy, you know, mm-hmm. and I'd go in, and her father was the one that ran the photograph. He was the original owner of the photograph shop, and I would carry him, I'd give him cigars, you know. I didn't smoke, so I gave him a cigar. And he'd take that cigars and poke them in his pocket. And years later, I learned that he didn't smoke. I wondered what he did with them. Somebody said he probably sold them.
Yeah.
But anyhow, when I got home, I decided to write these people and see if I could get back in contact with them, and I did, and we're still in communication. But those people now, this little boy is a very famous, world famous photographer now. You remember when they, Argentina was thinking about going back to the Anar, going back to the king and, you know, monarchy, that's what I was trying to say.
I mean, that war that happened down there, the Falcon? Falkland War, or whatever it was?
No, it was since that. They were thinking about going back to the monarchy, and they had two people that were going to be either one of them was going to be the king. You uh-huh. know, one of them was about a 60-year-old man, and the other one was a 20-some-year-old.
Uh-huh.
So they sent Horst, this is the Austin boy I was talking about, uh-huh. they sent him there to photograph these people, and he photographed them for town and country.
Mm-hmm.
And he's quite a famous worldwide famous photographer now. Mm. His name is Horst Stastny.
Mm.
And on Christmas Day this year, we were gone for a while and came back, and on the answering machine, here was Horst with a message for us.
How about it?
From Austria.
Isn't that great?
And we had been back since the war. We've been back a couple of times to see him. And I went over and mm-hmm. my wife and got very close to Horst's mother, Teresa.
Mm-hmm.
She's still living. She's about 86 or 7 years old mm-hmm. now, I guess. She ran the photograph shop for many years after that.
Mm-hmm.
But she still lives in Bruck in her house there. And Horst lives in a town called Wells. Austria. But he comes to the United States on a pretty regular basis, and he has he teaches sometime at this photography school out in Santa Barbara, California. Mm-hmm. And he's one of those guys that seems to get close to anybody. He he gets close to the movie stars out there, and he knows some of them personally. And I don't know him, and here I am, an American, and I don't know him. But
so how long did you stay in Bruck?
I went to Bruck and I don't remember the month, but yeah, I was there for 3 or 4 months, I guess, maybe a little longer. And they got shipped up to Salzburg, Austria. And while I was there, they were trying these Hungarians for shooting American flyers that mm-hmm. parachuted down. There's four American flyers that had parachuted down, and these Hungarians had shot and killed them. And so they were in a trial, and I was a marshal in that trial. And I left in June coming back home, and that trial still wasn't over with, but they had, I had the fellow, there was another, they had two officers that were marshals, and of course we had the MPs that were under us,
mm-hmm.
that really took care of the prisoners and everything, but I had him writing me back to what they did, and they sentenced all four of the officers that were involved in it to be hanged.
Mm-hmm.
And the enlisted man who actually did the shooting, they gave them life in prison.
Oh, really?
But they told in that trial how these men begged for their lives, and they went ahead and shot them just in cold blood. And of course, like I said, the enlisted men were the ones that actually did the shooting, but the officers who were involved
gave the order.
Were the ones that they sent us to hang.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was a veterinarian. His name was Bacos. And during the trial, they brought out that somebody was sick in the outfit, and they said, well, Dr. Bacos would take care of him, but said he'd have to get out on all fours for him to treat him.
So when did you finally get out of the service?
Okay.
What was that process like?
They shipped me back from Austria to the staging area at Lucky Strike.
Yeah.
And I was there for maybe a week, and came back in June of 1946, June.
Now, did you come back on a troop ship of some
troop
kind?
Troop ship. I came back on the Maritime Victory.
Mm-hmm.
I was left out of Le Havre, and the first 4 days, the ocean was rough, and I was sick again for 4 days. Then the ocean became just like a lake. You know, it was. I didn't realize that it could be that calm, and you could see the in the distance. You could see the porpoises, or the porpoises were coming under the ships, and all. But anyhow, you could see whales in the distance, you know, spouting it. And we landed in New York. I don't remember the exact date in June, but it was in June of 1946. Mm-hmm. And I landed there, and they sent me out to Camp Kilmer to be staged to come home. And they had a troop train coming from Kilmer to Fort Bragg, and I was in charge of the train.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I guess my name was B, you know, up the head of the list.
They so were you still a second lieutenant at that time?
I was the first lieutenant.
First lieutenant.
Yeah. And I was mustered out at Fort Bragg.
Mm-hmm.
Came in on in Fort Bragg, the delivering carrier for Fort Bragg at that time was the Aberdeen Rockfish Railroad, and that was a railroad that my dad first started work on.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Aberdeen Rockfish. Boy, that's quite a name. So, how did you get back from Fort Bragg up? You came back to Reedsville, I think.
My wife met me there at Bragg, and my little boy that I had never seen.
Oh, yes.
I met there for the first time. He was 11 months old.
How about it?
And
what a thrill.
It was a time I won't forget.
I'm sure. So your wife had a car at that time,
yeah.
I take it? So you had a car?
She was working during the war, and if you were working, she was a home economist.
Mm-hmm.
She was at the extension service in Durham, and that's where I met her. And she had a car, she had an automobile,
mm-hmm.
and you could buy one during the war, and she could travel. She had stamps, you know,
mm-hmm.
Russian stamps,
yeah.
For gasoline. course, she wasn't supposed to use it for anything except work, and she didn't. She was very conscientious about that. And as a matter of fact, that was one of the reasons, I guess, the way I really met her. I was going to a basketball game over at Duke. NC State was playing Duke, and she was catching a bus out to go to the game, and that's where I met her. And we hit it off from there. Been together for 58 years, almost 58 years now. Well, it's over 58 but we've been married almost. Come February the 1st, we'll be married 58 years.
Mm-hmm. How about it? So you came back to, did you come back, come to Reidsville at that time, or did you go somewhere?
Well, yeah, we came to here, right here to this White House, and her parents, she was living, she stayed with them when I went overseas.
So her parents owned this house right out here that I turned left in front of.
So she came back there, and when I came out of the service, my people lived at Apex, but she was an only child, and so we came back here and stayed until, this is in June, and I went back to school in September, went back to NC State. And we bought a old trailer to live in out there at, they had a place called Trailwood on the campus at NC State. And we put that trailer out there, and we lived in that until the next June when I graduated.
And then briefly, Warren, just what did you do in your career? You came back?
Okay, I graduated in agronomy at NC State, and I had several offers of different jobs, but I chose to go with the research station, and I went in as a tobacco supervisor, they call it tobacco, on a research station, and in about 8 months after that, I guess it was, a fellow that was superintendent of the station died, and I became superintendent of that station, and then I went from there, from this was at McCullough's, just out of Raleigh, it was a small research station, and I was there for about 5 years, and then went, almost six, and then went to Rocky Mount in charge of the Upper Coastal Plain Research Station. And then went from there to in charge of the largest station at Salisbury, called the Piedmont Research Station. And I was superintendent there, which is the manager of the station. And when my wife's parents were getting old, and she was the only child, and so I took a job with the Extension Service here in Rockingham County as a demotion, I guess you'd say, in one way. But anyhow, we moved back here, and I finished out my retirement with the Extension Service here in Rockingham County.
And when did you retire?
In 1982.
So you've been living happily ever after here in Rockingham County. And you have one son that lives in Reidsville, right?
He's an attorney here, Dan Bailey, out at Wentworth. He lives out of Wentworth now.
And you have another child?
The other son went in the service for 10 years. He was in the Air Force. He was not a pilot. He was a ground officer. And both of them are NC State graduates, but the younger son, Dan, the one that's attorney here, went to law school over at Chapel Hill. And Bill got his master's degree from Ball State University. And they lived in the Boston area until recently. And Bill had a stroke, and so he's disabled. Although he gets around, it didn't affect his mind or anything, but they moved back to Chapel Hill. So they're living in Chapel Hill now, both of the boys in this area.
I see. Let me ask you a couple of questions here, just kind of general questions. And I think I know how you're going to answer this, but what kind of, what is your impression of the leadership that you experienced while you were in the service? I know there was one that was a bad experience, and then Morris was
It was mixed. Yeah. Let me tell you, it was mixed. We had a regimental executive officer who was from, I think, from Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
And I would put him in the idiot category. He was a big, gawky individual who liked to chew people out, but he always wanted an audience to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I never thought anything of that at all. I think the leadership there was absolutely, and the regimental communications officer was from, Minnesota, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, I think he ended up someplace in Montana.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't think too much of him. Our regimental commander, I thought a lot of. He was
Mark?
A West Pointer. And
Oh, no. Who was this then?
His name was Meridian.
Meridian.
And he was, I always thought an awful lot of him. I thought he was real good. I thought he was a good leader. And as I said, the battalion commander that we had prior to this Major Morris, who later became Lieutenant Colonel Morris, was superior. I couldn't say enough good things about him.
Mm-hmm.
As a leader and as a man.
Mm-hmm.
I just think he was just top notch.
Top notch, yeah.
But in general, I would say that the World War II leadership was very good. It had to be, but we had some bad apples in it, like we had in any
yeah,
case.
Right.
And this guy's name was Walkner. I don't mind telling his name. He was from, I think he's from Nebraska. And they said he was a butcher in civilian life, and I think he would have, I hate to say this, but I think he would have been a lot better for the war effort if he'd have stayed in that profession.
How was discipline in your the area that you were least exposed to among the men? Did you feel like they were under good discipline and were a good a group of people following orders and so forth? Or did you have any problems with
Naturally, we had some problems, but by and large, I think it was excellent. The American GI was, he had his own mind. The Germans, you know, they followed strictly, you know, whatever was told.
Yeah.
The GI had his own mind, as you know, although the good soldiers, and by and large, most of them were good soldiers, they had what we call American ingenuity, and they could do. When they get in a situation that a lot of people would break down, they somehow or another would come out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And by and large, I think that we just had excellent people.
Mm-hmm. Did you see any evidence of any discrimination among any groups of people?
Oh, yes. I mean, this is common in World War II, as you know, that the black troops. You had the black units and white units and.
How about any religious discrimination of any kind that you noticed?
Not a great deal. I think we had a Catholic chaplain in my outfit, and I thought the world of him. I was not Catholic. I was Protestant. But as far as from a religious standpoint, I don't ever recall any problems.
Wasn't an issue, huh?
Along that line.
Mm-hmm. Did you have occasion to be helped or helped by the USO or the Red Cross or any organization like that?
I never had any anything. I had some good friends that was with the Red Cross. fellow named Joe Archibald, who was there at 20 grand with us, and he became a lifelong friend. He was a friend until he died.
Mm-hmm.
And he was from Port Chester, New York, and he was an artist and a author. And he wrote something like 50 or 60 books for teenagers, mm-hmm. you know, and what have you. And he was a good artist, and I have some paintings of his that I'd like to show you before you
leave. Yeah, I'd love to see.
And the other fellow, it was another Red Cross director there named Vincent, who was a real nice fellow. The Red Cross always had these tents, you know, when it was overseas, it would serve donuts and things of this sort. And of course, they had some entertainment, sometimes good and sometimes not so good.
Did you see any of the big stars? I guess, you saw Frank Sinatra, but that was in another setting. Did you have any big-time entertainers come over and entertain the troops where you were?
Yeah, on several occasions, we had some that would come, you know, even down to the battalion level.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, some of them were good and some of them were not so good.
Yeah.
But by and large, I think everybody meant well,
mm-hmm.
I'll put it that way. And we had there 20 grand. We had the Red Cross unit there that served donuts. And there's these two Red Cross directors that I'm telling you about, the Joe Archibald and the Vincent fella. And they were always ready, willing, and able to help you in any way that they possibly could. Mm-hmm. I never had any occasion to use them on an emergency basis, mm-hmm. or anything of this sort.
I guess some fellows did if they had a death of a parent or something.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever.
And then, of course, you had some people, you know, create a problem,
to get out of the
emergency
situation.
Wasn't much of that.
Do you feel like you were fairly well informed as to what was happening in the war while you were up there on the front lines for the most part, once you got into action?
I guess as well as could be expected.
Being in communications, you may have known a little bit more than some others, perhaps, since you were in communications.
Yeah. Let me give you a little story if you have a time.
Oh yeah, let's stop right here and we'll switch the other side.
End of tape B, side one. The interview continues with tape B, side two.
Oh, okay, you got a story.
Okay, as you know, in those days, telephones were not, you know, you didn't have them everywhere. There was one in this community out here. The fellow that owned Big Apple, the farm supply in Reedsville.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He lived right up just a short distance from here, and was very close friends of my wife's family. And I was on a leave. This was after the war, and I was in Switzerland, and they said, "Well, you can call home, you know, if you can." But you got to put your call in one day and maybe be a day or two. But they'll inform you as to when the call will come through.
Mm-hmm.
So I hadn't talked to my wife, you know, in several months. And so I put in a call from a little town in Switzerland called Glion, which is just above Montreux.
Mm-hmm.
On the mountainside there, and Hotel Victoria, I was staying at. I put it in, and like today and tomorrow, they said, "Well, your call will come through." Well, like it's on Saturday, and so my wife got the word But I had to put it in to Mr. Apple's telephone. Mm-hmm. They didn't have a telephone.
Right.
And so they came to church and said, told Ruth, said, you have a telephone call coming in. So she rushed and got a son, and her mother came with her over to Mr. Apple's house, and the telephone came through talking to her, and she was wanting Bill, that's our son, was a little boy at that time. She wanted to make some kind of noise, you know, that I could hear. And she was trying to pinch him, and her mother was slapping her, trying to get him to cry or do something.
Right,
you know.
Yeah.
Anyhow, he said he just wouldn't make any noise at all. But that was how the communication was at that time.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no, it wasn't easy, was it?
No.
How about the health of your unit and the medics, the care that you got when you were up front? Did you feel like if you got hurt, you were going to be taken care of, at least within reason?
Within reason,
with medical care,
I should say. But let me, now your son is a dentist, and I would say a very excellent dentist. If I could have had him, I might have had some better teeth now. But anyhow, the dentist had to fill teeth with had somebody peddling the thing, you know,
yeah, right.
So sort of thing. So they did the best they could.
Yeah.
And
you had medics in your outfit that were
excellent
medics.
I mean, as far as devotion is concerned,
yeah.
You got to give those guys all kind of credit.
Yeah.
When people were injured on the battlefield and they didn't have a gun,
right.
They couldn't carry a gun. And they would come out and they'd go out and get them. And I can't say enough good things about the medics in World War II. Now, and they did the best they could with what they had.
Mm-hmm. What's your overall opinion of the enemy that you were facing?
Fanatical. They were fanatical. And let me go back and tell you something that I forgot to tell you about. My outfit, I'm trying to say captured, liberated, I guess you'd say, the first concentration camp on the Western Front.
Okay, which one was that?
The town of Ordruff.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I guess, one of the two things that we did, I think, that stand out more than anything else, was the crossing of the Rhine, or saw a crossing of the Rhine, and the liberation of this concentration camp, which was a satellite camp for Buchenwald.
Mm.
And this is the town of Ordruff, and I couldn't believe, and I'll show you some pictures of this in the division paper. Just before we got to the camp, or as we were approaching the camp, this SS sergeant killed about 35 people right there in one pile.
Hmm.
Had them in one group. And
just right before you got there?
Just before we got there.
Is
just
that
before
right?
We got there. Of course, they were starved to death, as you'll see in the pictures. But he just machine gunned them down, and he got about 50, 75 yards away, and our tanker made a sifter out of him. He killed him right there, then and there. And this was a tanker that got him. And had burned a lot of people. They were usually walk them when they felt like it was pretty close to death. They would march them to Buchenwald, which is about 100 and some miles away, I believe they said.
They would march them there?
Yeah, yeah. And they'd carry them there to finish them off. But anyhow, a lot of them would die before they left there, and they had these railroad irons that they fixed like that, and they'd put them on it and then they'd burn them. And we captured this, and now, I wasn't personally, don't get me wrong, I wasn't personally involved in this. I was there shortly after that, but it was something of a sight that I don't believe in anybody that could ever look at it and have a, you know, have a different feeling. But the people there in the town of Ordruff claimed they didn't know anything at all about it. And so our regimental commander got the Burgermeister and made everybody in town walk by there and see it. They marched them by to let them see everything there. That night he committed suicide.
The Burgermeister?
The Burgermeister did.
Is that right?
Well, Patton came up and he got sick. Old blood and guts himself, you know, just it was such a sight that he just got sick of it. And so he called Eisenhower and Bradley up to, and they were going to bring in the press the next day. And we wondered why this was never publicized. You probably never heard of Ordruff, had you?
Not really.
And we wondered why.
Heard of Buchenwald, of course.
Yeah, Buchenwald, because it was much larger. So yeah. They figured they killed about 12,000 at Ordruff. Of course, Buchenwald was much larger. And the Russians, you know, the Americans captured Buchenwald, the Russians captured Auschwitz and so forth. But anyhow, on that front over there, but they hadn't captured Buchenwald at the time we captured or liberated this. Mm-hmm. And Ordruff, let me go back a bit and say that Eisenhower and Bradley and Patton had planned to call a big news conference and so forth, and nobody ever heard of it. And the reason was that Patton went back to his trailer. You know, he had a trailer there that he'd go back at night, and he always listened in on BBC to get the time and have his time set right and everything. And that night they announced that Roosevelt had died. And so that took away all of the publicity that would have gone into this particular thing.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
And we had wondered, and some guy later on reading of discovered that was the reason. We never heard much about it. But it is in the archives in Washington, you know, and everything. And it was a terrible sight. And going back to what I think in the German people, I think, by and large, a lot of them were good people, I don't think. But they were naive, apparently, as to what a lot of the things were going on. And I guess they had gone through a terrible depression themselves, and
yeah.
They got an idiot that that took over.
Yeah, right. Just briefly, what's your recollection of the feelings that you had when you were doing your job on the front lines and going across the Rhine River and getting shot at? Can you kind of reconstruct your thoughts that were going through your mind at that time?
I can. When I was lying in that ditch, waiting to catch the duck to go across.
Yeah.
Now, I hadn't actually ever seen the river because I'd been close to it, but I'd never seen it. And I remembered studying the Rhine River when I was in grade school, you know. I thought, what a heck of a way it is to see the Rhine the first time. And we crossed just above the Lower Lie. You know where the Lower Lie is.
I've heard, but I don't know.
The Lower Lie is a thatcher down there in the middle of the river that supposed to have taken care of the ancient mariners and so forth. But we were just above that. One of our units went across right at the Lower Lie.
Mm-hmm.
But
so did you think much of your own personal safety, or were you more focused on what you had to do?
It had to be on what I had to do, because I knew what was in front of me, and I was afraid. Now, don't let me tell you, and let anybody tell you, that they can be in a situation there, and that you can say either one or two things. You're If they tell you they're not afraid, they're either lying or they're an idiot. I was afraid. I didn't, under normal circumstances, I wouldn't have wanted to gone out there.
No.
But I had the duty to do, and I knew that I was supposed to lead my men across there.
Did you ever hear Axis Sally or anybody on the radio that, the propaganda?
I really didn't. I never, because I didn't listen to the radio much. I had too many other things to do.
How about enemy propaganda or any leaflets dropping on you or any of this kind of thing?
No, I never had any of that.
Okay. How about things that affected the morale of your unit, like mail from home, if the guys didn't get it, what? Did it put them in a foul mood or depressed mood or this kind of thing?
Well, how
big a deal was mail? Let's put it
mail was a big deal. Let me tell you, it was a big deal. And that, going back to what I was telling you about censoring that thing, this is where it was so sensitive to me to have to read somebody else's mail and to have somebody writing to his wife or his girlfriend or what have you. And for me to have to read it was just the most unpleasant thing that I ever had to do running the service. But it was something, and I can tell you to this day, not even my wife, I've never even mentioned anything that I ever read.
Yeah. How about the psychological stress? Did you see any evidence of fellow soldiers who were really suffering from psychological stress or shell shock, whatever you want to call it?
Had one boy in my not in my platoon, but in my company. They finally had to ship him out. He had a psychological problem.
But he just couldn't function? Like give you just a stare?
He just went off of the rocker.
Yeah.
And they, I don't know whatever happened to him, really. Yeah. He left the outfit, and I never knew it. But as in basic training, I had a boy that was not in my company, but in another company. The old sergeant was pretty rough on him. He wasn't sympathetic with him at all. And I don't know whatever happened to him. But I guess in that time, people didn't listen to too much in the way of psychology.
Yeah, right. Anything in the way of Hollywood movies that ring a familiar chord with you as you see any particular movies that you think kind of depict combat as you knew it pretty well?
Not really. They usually glamorize the thing, to the point that I don't know. I'm not much on war movies.
Yeah, you were there firsthand. You don't have to see them. Huh? Any other well-known people that you saw? Any high-ranking officers or whoever?
Let me tell you, I was in Patton's outfit, and I never saw Patton.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I saw Eisenhower after the war, and it was a parade in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
I saw him personally, but I never saw Patton. He was close to me a lot of times, and everybody was shaky when he was around, But I never saw him.
Did he strike fear into the hearts of the soldiers?
Yeah, he struck fear. Listen, I shaved every day. This was one of the things, and you didn't go around with a beard or anything of that sort in Patton's army. Let me go back a little bit, and I'll tell you about I was passing through Scranton, Pennsylvania, spent the night there in the Sheraton Hotel, and the next morning I got up in the cold water, and I had to shave with cold water, and I complained to the management that they didn't pay any attention to it. So I wrote the Sheridan headquarters in Boston, and I told them about the cold water and everything. And I said, and I shaved with cold water, and I said it was an art that I developed while serving with General Patton in World War II. And they sent me a complimentary knife to say that.
Good, good. That's great. Before the last couple of questions I want to ask you, tell me quickly, because I don't have a whole lot of tape left, about the little girl. We talked about that much earlier.
Okay. In 1994 or somewhere in that neighborhood, mm-hmm. I started looking for her. I went to the...
Now, did you have her name?
Yeah.
You had her name.
Yeah, I had her name down, and I didn't have it spelled exactly right.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I had her name, Mary, M-A-R-Y, and it's M-A-R-Y-E, I believe it is, in French. But anyhow, I started looking for her, and I went to the French embassy in Washington. I didn't get beyond the secretary or the telephone operator. They referred me to French consul general in Atlanta, and no help there. And so in our division newspaper, they had a article, and this fellow, this girl on the French coast on Normandy had written to this GI. She wanted to get in touch with some GIs in the States. So I immediately wrote her and told her and sent her the picture of the girl. You know, and I had some photographs made. I sent a picture. And so in one day's time, she found her.
Yes,
they were
right.
About 60 kilometers apart. And she called this town of Latreport with everybody with that last name. She finally, she went to the one woman, the last woman that she was talking to, and she said, "Well, Mary Louise is my daughter." And so she wrote me a letter then, this young girl did, wrote me a letter, and she was overjoyed by finding her everything. And
she's 60 years old now, I guess. Or
62 at the time that
I... 62,
she's
yeah.
over that now. She's 60.
Yeah, 75,
somewhere in that neighborhood now. But anyhow, later on, and we had knew some... This French lady lives close by here, and she's stepping out a little bit too. But anyhow, they asked if they could come and stay with us for 2 weeks. I said, you know, I wouldn't do it now because I'm advanced to the age that I don't know where I can do it or not. But anyhow, we said, yeah, they came, and they spent 2 weeks.
That was her mother and the daughter?
No, this is the young girl that uh-huh. found her.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, it lived about 60 kilometers away. This woman and her husband.
Uh-huh.
And her is a real long story that I can't, you know, go into all of
but
it.
But this particular
anyhow,
girl.
This little girl, this young girl, or the woman, Mary Louise, the one that was a little girl when I was over there, her father, I found out, had just been killed by a landmine out there on the beach. He was unemployed. He was unemployed, and he had five children.
Oh,
Mary Louise was the second child, and she was the one that had the personality. Her older sister apparently didn't, and she would go out scrounging food, you know, and everything. And she'd come out, and she just had a magnetic personality.
Now, did she actually come here, you say?
Yeah. Yeah, she stayed with us for 2 weeks here in the South.
Okay.
She and this young girl that had found her.
Yeah.
And this woman's husband.
Oh, okay.
The three of them stayed here.
So they stayed here.
And the young girl could speak just a little bit of English. The other two didn't speak any.
Oh, my God.
So between a lady who teaches French over at the academy over in High Point, and this French lady who married an American, lives over at High Point. Between those two and little help, we got by
Isn't
for 2 weeks, but it wasn't easy.
So 50 years later, she comes here and visits.
Right.
You. How about it?
Right.
Well, did you recognize her at all?
Oh, no. Nothing, you know, that about her, but she still has a dynamic personality.
Uh-huh.
She's just outgoing person that you can tell that she just, if I could speak French, I think I could really enjoy her.
Yeah.
But she just has a good, a real outgoing personality.
Yeah.
And that's the way she was then. She's a little girl that just captivated you.
Yeah,
you know.
Right.
Like I said, I would write my wife and tell her about how this little girl that I had met, and that she's just I wish we had one like her and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, right.
She was 12 years old, and I thought she was 8 because she's so small, you know.
Yeah. Characterize your service for me. What do you think about what you did back then?
What
do you think about what you did back then? Just your overall experience.
Well, I hope I helped the war effort. I felt good about what I did. I don't know what the other people thought about what I did or anything of this sort. But I do now, what is encouraging to me now and that I feel good about is some young people that come up to me and tell me how much they appreciate what,
yeah.
Not me, but, you know, all of us in World War II,
right.
What we did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it makes it. I have a good feeling about that.
Have you been to any of the high schools around with the Combat Airmen Group?
I haven't. I haven't. I really need to.
I think you have a good story to tell. How did it change your life? How did your experience in World War II change your life?
Well, I think it changed it in a lot of ways. I don't know what I would have done, you know, if I hadn't met my wife that I met. To begin with,
mm-hmm.
That was, I guess, probably the one thing that changed my life as much as anything else.
Mm-hmm.
She was an only child, but a person that she has a magnetic personality, and it's not me, but I mean a lot of other people tell me the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And she's put up with a lot of
my
idiosyncrasies or whatever you want to call them. But anyhow, she's put up with me all these years, and I guess we've endured a lot of hardships together. And I wouldn't. Not many things I'd change.
Yeah, right. Anything else you want to add, Warren, before we close this up?
Well, the only thing I'd say, Ken, is I appreciate you coming, and I hope that I've given you a few things out of World War II that some people might enjoy. And
they will. This is for history. This is for future generations to. I think about how wonderful it would be if I were able to listen to like my mother, my wife's great great grandfather served in the Civil War, and I think wouldn't it be magnificent if we'd had the technology to listen to him reminisce about what his experiences were. So these are for your kids, your grandkids, and a lot of people that come after that. So
well, I hope some people will listen to it.
I know they will. Listen, thank you very much, Warren. I really appreciate being with you here today, and I'll be looking forward to hearing
looking
at some of your pictures and stuff.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. This concludes the interview with Warren Bailey.
As usual, I gave a copy of the tape to Warren, as well as, of course, putting them into the archives and the local libraries. But this is Warren's comment to me after he listen to the tapes, and I thought it was very nice, and put this on the end of his original tape so that you can hear what he had to say.
Ken, this is Warren Bailey. I was just calling to thank you for making the tapes. I picked them up the other day, finally got them from at the meeting, and they were very professionally done, and my son, one of them I've given to, and the other one I'll see Sunday, and they are very proud of them, and we appreciate it more than I can tell you. And I do hope that your wife is doing better. My number, in case you want to call me, is 349-8630. Thank you.
As I listen to this tape in preparation for doing the newspaper article on Warren, it's June the
27th, Sunday evening. I called Warren and asked him about some other things. One was, while he was in Brook, he stayed in a castle that was one of Hermann Göring's many palatial homes that he had throughout Europe. Göring was a fanatic who collected homes as well as rare art, tapestries, and of course, beautiful women. As the troops neared the castle, Göring's lady friend committed suicide by jumping from the window of her room, which incidentally was the room that Warren Bailey used when he stayed in that castle. And Warren also brought home with him some parts of place settings of China that Göring had in that castle, which is very nice, which he uses occasionally today. Some of them are big platters and so forth. And he also has a painting, watercolor, done of that castle in his home that was done by a German artist at the time. It's a kind of a long-distance painting, you might say, the castle, but anyway, it is the castle is in the painting, and it's kind of a reminder of his time while he was in that location. Warren also mentioned that concerning the time when he was a marshal for the Hungarian SS troops that shot the American flyers, he was curious about what actually happened to those troops, and he called the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., and found a lady who was very helpful, and through her help, she found a newspaper article. He found a newspaper article dated the 10th of June, 1946, which he's going to send to me, which tells of the conviction of the SS officers and the enlisted men who had been found guilty of murdering the Allied flyers. So I just wanted to add this to Warren's tape so it'll be a little more complete. I'm writing the article now. It'll be published on July the 4th of 2004. So I'm looking forward to get that in print, and Warren says he's looking forward to seeing it in print too.